Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, my name is Maureen McDonald from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2019 Walter Magazine. Even if it's been decades since you picked up a school book, the first fall breeze can make you feel like learning something. Consider some new nonfiction from one of these local authors. Former News and Observer reporter and Piedmont laureate Scott Hewler retraces an English explorer's 550-mile trek through the Carolinas in A Delicious Country, rediscovering the Carolinas along the route of John Lawson's 1700 expedition. On shelves next month, UNC Asheville professor Daniel S. Pierce recounts the history of moonshine in our state and the lively mix of characters that kept stills going from Prohibition to the present in Tar Heel Lightning, how secret stills and fast cars made North Carolina the moonshine capital of the world. This October, Saltbox Seafood Joint chef Ricky Moore brings his popular fare to home cooks. The talent behind the Durham restaurant and food truck shares his tips on frying, grilling, smoking, and more. The famous pitmaster of Skylight Inn in Aden, North Carolina, Sam Jones, debuts his first book, sharing his secrets of North Carolina-style whole hog barbecue, with a book titled Whole Hog Barbecue. Out this month, James Beard Cookbook Hall of Fame member Gene Anderson merges two North Carolina maker pastimes in a story-driven guide to cooking in clay in Kiln to Kitchen, favorite recipes from beloved North Carolina potters. And lastly, from drivable dunes to arcane history, Raleigh native Glenn Morris will surprise even seasoned beachgoers with this well-researched new guide to North Carolina beaches. And continuing in the food theme, we have Savor, All in the Family. Bella Monica serves Italian-American fare inspired by Nana's Kitchen by Catherine Curran. I was very lucky to grow up in a large Italian family, says Corbett Monica. My grandmother was the matriarch, and everyone came to her house after church on Sundays. Every week it would change on who would show up, but there was always someone there. And no matter who came, there was one constant, loads and loads of food. In New York and New Jersey, where Monica and his wife Julie are from, Italian-American restaurants are pretty common, but down here, they're more of a novelty. So just a year after the couple moved here in 1999 with hopes of opening a restaurant, they opened Bella Monica, named after Julie, the quote, beautiful Monica, as an homage to the family-owned joints they missed. It was always going to be Italian, says Monica. Bella Monica is the food that we grew up with. It's our heritage food. When they bought the location that would be their restaurant, it was a takeout pizza place in a shopping strip at the corner of Edwards Mill and Dura Lee Roads. We really piecemealed it together as we grew, says Monica. The unassuming restaurant has evolved to include a small bar, some booths, an outdoor patio, and a private room for special events. The walls are adorned with rotating local art. Dozens of Italian wine bottles are proudly displayed behind the bar. It's cozy, it's unfussy, and it's a welcoming spot that has become a neighborhood favorite and a celebration night destination for Raleighites over the past two decades. Monica loves his regulars and has enjoyed watching families grow up through the restaurant, visiting for birthdays, anniversaries, and even prom dinners, the same sort of family atmosphere his grandmother established in her home. While the restaurant has never done formal advertising, Monica says word of mouth has been their best asset. It's been important to be able to grow like that in this community. It's honest. It's genuine. In regard to the menu, it leans Italian-American to be distinguished from Italian-Italian. You'd be hard-pressed to find a chicken parmesan on a menu in Italy, laughs Monica. Here you can enjoy a plate of piping hot lasagna, smothered in cheese and gravy. That's tomato sauce for the lay folks. With a hefty glass of house red wine, their signature Caesar salad topped with roasted red peppers, or warm house-made focaccia topped with olive oil, onion, and chive. Monica says his executive chef, Alex Martinez, is making the family proud after 16 years with the restaurant. Alongside perennial favorites, Martinez invites new recipes into the mix every now and then, based on travels and food trends, like low-carb options among the pasta-forward selections, or unique takes on old favorites. See the crab flatbread, their pizza-esque version of a crab cake. There's an entire section titled Favorites from Nana's Cucina, including the baked ziti. Monica refers to it as mac and cheese, the first thing he learned to cook with his grandmother. He chose his mother's method of preparing meatballs and gravy, however. My grandmother cooked them in the sauce, but my mom pan-fried them before adding the sauce, says Monica. I do it my mom's way because it adds another level of texture and flavor. In 2017, the Monicas opened Stellino's in West Cary, the sister restaurant to Bella Monica. It's named for his teenage daughter, Stella. Monica says with the success and loyal following of Bella Monica, it was a natural progression to open a second restaurant in a new neighborhood. There's so much great community here. When we moved here and opened Bella Monica, we wanted people to come into our restaurant and feel comfortable, enjoy themselves, and have some delicious food. It's all about communities, taking care of communities. This article was edited for Time. In words and song, Mary Williams teaches and inspires with her genre-blending performances by Laurie D.R. Wiggins. If you ever share a space with Mary D. Williams, listen and learn. What you'll experience is a soul-electrifying blend of traditional gospel songs laced with slave spirituals. They're woven into sobering, yet often upbeat, lessons about how music both sustained and empowered slaves, energized the civil rights movement, and spawned social change. Music is a part of every era of our lives. Music can be heard when speech cannot, Williams says. Alternating between sage storyteller and contralto songstress, Williams shares how slaves spoke, lamented, and hoped with each other and God through tunes that floated over the fields for hundreds of miles and generations beyond. She shares how the Fisk Jubilee Singers, a black a cappella ensemble, introduced African-American talent to a world accustomed to minstrel shows. She shares how the Wings Over Jordan Choir, the first black professional choir, used its songs of praise to support the civil rights movement and codify the instrumentation and harmonies that now distinguish gospel music. They used the music of the enslaved as a weapon of social change, says Williams. The gospel singer, historian, and educator believes this music can build community now, just as it did then. Williams was raised in rural Garner, the oldest of two children to John and Ellen Dobbin. She grew up on the knees of grandparents who lived in Johnston County, a place still notorious for its billboard welcome in the 1970s. This is Klan country, love it or leave it. She remembers facing discrimination while shopping with her grandmother. In those moments, her grandmother simply pulled Williams closer. But back at home, Williams could hear her grandmother in the kitchen, humming tunes with a moan, no words. When you moan, the devil don't know what you're talking about, she recalls her grandmother saying. William's father sang in the Dependable Quintet for as long as she can remember. He still sings in the church choir today. She credits a middle school chorus teacher for urging her to sing. She graduated from Garner High School in 1979, then spent a year at college before returning home to work. In 1992, Williams married Alvin D. Williams, and they had three sons, each 6 years apart, then two grandsons. Over the years, Williams balanced family life with a 30-year career as a Medicaid case manager. And all the while, Williams was still performing music near and dear to me, she says. She sang at churches and community events, made award-winning rounds on the Gospel Fest circuit, and recorded three solo albums. Even so, she says, I didn't feel I belong. Her repertoire of slave spirituals and traditional gospel songs was different from the contemporary gospel flooding festivals and airwaves. But Williams persisted, rejecting suggestions she follow the crowd. In 2005, Williams met historian Timothy B. Tyson, author of Blood Done Sign My Name, which explores the 1970 murder of a 23-year-old black veteran by three white men in his hometown of Oxford, North Carolina, at a community racial reconciliation event at William Peace University. She sang, he discussed his book. The two joined forces soon after, traveling the country on conversation-style book tours. The next year, Williams and Tyson were asked to develop a course curriculum to help bridge the racial divides that lingered in the wake of the Duke LaCrosse case. Called The South in Black and White, Politics, History, and Culture Along the Color Line in the 20th Century South, the class was first taught at the Haiti Heritage Center in Durham to students from Duke, North Carolina Central, and UNC Chapel Hill, and is now a course offering to students from Durham Technical Community College, as well as community members. In 2015, Williams graduated with honors from UNC Chapel Hill with a degree in American Studies and minors in History and African American Studies. On Mother's Day this year, she earned a master's degree in folklore from Carolina, and her unique talents for storytelling through music has earned her recognition far beyond the triangle. Every time I work with teachers, I want Mary there, says Christy Norris, director of Carolina K-12, a public humanities program at UNC Chapel Hill, charged with educating teachers through professional development opportunities. This past summer, Norris enlisted Williams to present Carolina Voices, exploring the history and heritage of the Tar Heel State. In it, she explored aspects of a shared history often swept under the rug. She's helping teachers invest in and engage with hard history in a welcoming and productive way, Nora says. Music can empower and also disarm us, so we can come together around tough issues. In July, William sang songs of protest and promise at the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C., as a performer at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival. Mary has a way of explaining the music without being didactic, and follows it with a gorgeous voice that leaves the audience captivated and enthralled, says Sabrina Lynn Motley, the festival's director. Whether she's holding a mic at a podium or emerging from the wings, William's presentations are always interactive and always begin with a song. The audience is encouraged to join in. After guests sang along for a portion of Down in the Valley to Pray at her Kennedy Center performance, Williams explained why. These songs started with individuals and built a community, just as we just did, she says. No one handed you any music or compositions or lyrics, but we passed this among ourselves, and we now have this one thing in common. It allowed us to become a community. From the Oxford America's statewide singing circle at A.J. Fletcher Opera Theater, to a recent trip to Montpellier, France, as part of Pavillon Populaire's I Am a Man exhibit, William's indelible mastery of music and history has carved a place for her in spaces she never imagined she'd enter. I'm honored, said Williams. I'm just so overwhelmed by the opportunities. I could not have written this for myself. I'm just so in awe of the Lord giving me the gift and then Him giving me these opportunities to use my gift. And next is playful painting. Motherhood and a Soul for Poetry infuse Eleanor Scott Davis's Colorful Abstract Art by Addie Ladner. At the base of her easel is a toddler-sized wooden rocking chair, a row of her abstract paintings, and a child's art cart. To the side, a bed for afternoon naps and cartoons. For nearly 3 years, Eleanor Scott Davis has been painting out of her home studio, something she's turned into a thriving business. Since the beginning, Davis created her work with her three daughters, first Avery, now 5, then Julia, 4, and Derby, 1, at her feet and by her side. Painting became a way to put beauty out in the world and to let my kids be who they are, she says. Motherhood doesn't just inspire her paintings. It's integrated into every stroke. When I look at my work, I can see when there was peace and I was alone. When someone needed a snack, or when I had to separate the kids, says Davis. While many parents keep their work and family life separate, these two spheres in Davis's life are unable to exist without the other, and her paintings have become her sort of chronicle of motherhood. My children have become a huge part of my artistic process. I'm such an impulsive person and don't think about my next move. But because they're with me to break up my work, it makes me step away and come back with fresh eyes, she says. Though her days may be driven by the little women in her home, Davis doesn't have a necessarily feminine style. Even when she uses pink, she eschews delicacy or daintiness. Her acrylic on canvas pieces are filled with saturated pops of ochre, blue, and green. She finds she's drawn to colors that mimic her upbringing along the lush landscape of eastern North Carolina. Abstract or not, I see landscapes in all my paintings, she says. There's something I feel when I enter my home county, that straight horizon and the smell of the turkey houses. There's nothing like it. If you're at Davis's home during bath time, she'll likely be reciting Shel Silverstein's famous poem, Crowded Tub. There are too many kids in the tub, there are too many elbows to scrub. That hints at another talent. Davis has a Master of Fine Arts in creative writing and originally wanted to be a poet, but found it was not an easy job to write with young children, nor was it particularly easy to sell a poem. Looking back, I couldn't make it as a poet, she says, laughing. But she finds parallels between these two forms of self-expression. Her art is abstract and open to one's imagination, just like a poem. It's vague enough for people to interpret it in their own way, she says. These days, she taps her creative writing talents to articulate the stories behind her bodies of work. One collection was inspired by the fleeting and tedious concept of time, another by the concept of balance, both in her use of color and shape and in the many facets of her life. I'm always attracted to symmetry. It's not pleasing, but interesting, she says. Anne's works in the collection are poetically and poignantly titled, including Hanging by a Thread, The Only Way Out is Through, and All Things Considered. While balance may be challenging and time fleeting, Davis's paintings bring her joy, and that, alongside her family, is enough. I think it's okay for art just to make people happy, and that's what art is for me. Davis's work can be found on her website, eleanorscottdavis.com. A photographer and his family take an almost perfect staycation on Jordan Lake in Lake Escape by Joshua Stedman. A few weeks ago, the team at Walter asked me to take photos of my family camping and fishing. I'll preface the following by mentioning that we are not a family that camps much, but my wife Carla, daughter Olive, 12, and sons Vaughn, 10, and Town, 7, were game. We chose to have our outdoor staycation at Jordan Lake. It was the easiest for us to get to and had the most open water, a must since I had planned to meet up with my friend, Rob Barton, for some fishing on the second day. We opted for the primitive campsites at New Hope Overlook. Hot dogs cooked over a campfire, roasted marshmallow and s'mores were essential bargaining chips for convincing my family this was a good idea. After parking, we took a short hike through the available campsites, picking one with the best view of the water and what we thought was a good, flat, hard-packed dirt area close to the fire pit. We then set up our two tents with efficiency, one for boys and one for girls, we'd practiced at the house, and started a fire right away. Well, not right away, but after 10 to 15 minutes of burning through a few sheaves of paper, twigs, and finally paper napkins, while trying to ignite the small pile of wood sold to us at the park office. But it was close enough to right away that it really gave us hope for an epic camping weekend. It was a memorable one, as you'll see. The drizzle began when we were getting into our tents. As we arranged ourselves and talked about the day, I had a smile on my face. What could be better than this? Time with my family and a bit of a photo essay to knock out in the morning. It was going to be a great weekend. The drizzle changed to a steady rain. I assured my youngest that all was fine. We just had to stay away from the edges. Touching the sides of the tent lets the moisture in, I said with confidence and looking back, a great deal of self-importance. The steady rain began to get heavier. It got really loud in the tent. We could no longer shout over to the girls' tent and laugh about the day. It's cool, I said. This should ease off soon. We all moved to the center of the tent. Then the rain actually slacked off. It got quieter. We all relaxed a bit. No problem. And then, with a big whoosh of sound, the big wet hand of Mother Nature squashed our little campsite. A bucket was upended on us. A river of rain fell from the sky. Inside our tent, the sound was deafening. After about 20 minutes, we'd had enough. The rain won. I called my wife's cell phone. The girls' tent was 5 feet away, but the rain was too loud to hear anything. "We've got to leave," I shouted. I didn't know if she heard me. I couldn't hear her. I couldn't hear anything other than occasional yelps from the boys and the hard-driving rain. I grabbed my camera bag, the boys put on shoes, and half-dressed, we started fast-walking back to the lot. It was pitch black, of course, and the path back was full of water. We stepped in most of the puddles we found. Finally, we made it back to our truck. And fortunately, it was only about 9 p.m., so the campsite gates weren't closed yet. We were able to get out. Everyone was soggy, but also really happy to be home, and we all fell asleep hard. The next morning, if you can believe it, we went back. The site was a wreck, and everything we'd brought was wet, but we were still game. We upended the tents to dry them out and took turns paddling around in the canoe and hanging around at the edge of the lake. Rob met up with us that morning, and we spent a few hours fishing. The kids had a blast. It turns out Rob is much more into fishing than I realized. He has a bass boat with a trolling motor and participates in fishing competitions. He's even won a few. He also knew a lot about Jordan Lake and gave us history lessons about the area. There's a whole town underneath the water, including railroad tracks, roads, and homes, all flooded to create the lake. At the end of the second day, we packed up the campsite and headed home. Everyone was tired but happy. The kids were proud of the fish they caught. Carla and I were proud of their bravery in the face of a real disaster. It was amazing how, even though we were only about 30 minutes from home, we felt like we were in a different world. Around here, you don't have to go far to escape the routine. Although, after that weekend, the kids have been acting a little more grateful for the routine. This article was edited for Time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.